Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and it's one of those, well, I want to say rare occasions, but they're getting less and less rare, where we are in the centre circle having our own stag do for one of our friends. And we've had quite a few stag do's recently for Stephen and for Paul, and it's another stag do for another one of our cohort. But before we get to the main guest and the main event, I will introduce the two best men who've also been invited on this stag do. First of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
Good evening, Stuart. How are we doing?
Good. Would you like to talk us through your arrival techniques for this podcast?
I totally forgot the kickoff time, and whereas last time, I think it was about 20 minutes late last time, just kicking back on the sofa. This time I was half an hour early, and then I slowly backed out of the session, only to return. And when I did return, I returned about 5 or 10 minutes late.
Yeah, how you've got the role of a best man, I've no idea. no one's giving you the rings.
There is definitely no way I am getting the bride to the church on time.
No. And with that, we're going to come to the far more responsible half of this duo. Mr. Aidan Williams. Aidan, how does it feel to be the most responsible?
Yeah, that's not a position I'm used to. I mean, in the grand tradition of any stag do's, I have been in the pub for an hour or two already at my son's cricket. And for Gary, I've got a Spanish beer as well. So there you go. Here's to you, Gary. If this is me as the responsible part of this pairing, it's not a good sign.
Brilliant. I've got one who's drinking and one who doesn't know what time the main event is.
Well, mind, I'm sober.
Okay, brilliant. I can see this is going to be really good and go really, really well. We will go to our guest first, because I've got quite a few questions, and I was going to ask one to Stephen, but I'm just going to ask it straight to the guest. So we are returning to Club Deportivo Retama. It is part two to the novel that is The Games People Play. It is the second part. It is a whole new ball game. It is Mr. Gary Thacker and his incredible football fiction. I want to call it a trilogy, but at the moment I don't want to put any pressure on him. So at the moment it's not a trilogy, but by the time we finish this, maybe we'll convince him that it is. Gary, first of all, welcome to the podcast and to your stag do.
Thank you, mate. I just want to know what time the strippers are going to arrive so I can tell the wife and close the bedroom door so she can see.
Well, we've got one drunk and one who doesn't know what time it is, so we're about on par for where we should be at this time of the night.
Sounds about right, mate, yeah. Yeah, thanks, mate.
So the book's out. The book is already... the book was out yesterday, I believe, at the time of recording.
That's correct.
And it's, like we say, it's part two to the games people play. Like we say, it is called A Whole New Ball Game. And it's funny because we were chatting just before we came on the podcast about how I'd listened to the previous podcast when I was trying to come up with a direction and some questions. And to be fair, I've probably just still got all the same questions and all the same discussion points that we had for the first time. But before we get into it, talk us through the games people play. So this was book one. This was your debut in football fiction. This is where you set the scene, you introduce characters, and clearly it doesn't matter about spoilers because this book's been out a year and hopefully people have already bought this and read this. So for this bit, there are no spoilers. So if you can just set the scene before we go into our chat about book two.
Sure, okay. Well, the book centres around a guy called John Morton who came to professional football quite late, and his career lasted 13 minutes, and he had a couple of bad injuries and had to sort of pack and play and became a coach. And he had a friend called Charlie Broom, whose father owned a local football club, and basically ended up coaching there. Turned to coach, he got his coaching badges, and ended up coaching there. And then the club was sold to some foreign investors, and Charlie Broom had bought this business in Spain. Right next to this business was a football club, which the local council wanted part of the deal, that when he bought the business, he bought the football club as well. And basically, he took John Morton out to Spain to take over, which is the club he mentioned, Club Deportivo Retama. It gets a little complicated, in as much as basically the club is in financial trouble, and it's been run by, coached by a girl who's taken over from her great uncle. John Morton is sort of parachuted in, and the first part of the book is all about how he gets involved with the club, gets to know the club and the players, and he ends up in a romantic relationship with Sophia. And towards the end, before that, when he was at the club before he got injured, there was a guy called Billy Swan, who is a sort of was an aging maverick footballer, and he had this idea when he was in Spain about bringing this guy out to Spain to play. He was in a little financial trouble back in the UK, owed a lot of some dodgy people some money, so he was sort of a prime candidate to get away for a bit. And basically, Charlie Broom, unbeknownst to John Morton, set up Billy Swan to make the club fail, because he wanted to sell the property to a company that could build a big factory on the premises there. And the story basically goes along that the club get to the playoff final, eventually after a few twists and turns on the way. Some of the players, you get to develop the characters, some of the players. And in the last game, Billy Swan misses a penalty. And it's a big point all the way through the book, Billy Swan never misses a penalty. He misses a penalty that could have won the game and then scores an own goal. And basically, they lose and they didn't get promoted. And the story goes at the end that part of the blackmailing that Charlie Broom had done with Billy Swan so they could pay off his debts was that he had to convince everybody that John Morton would be involved in the deception. And the story ends where his girlfriend Sophia, who's the girl who was coaching the club, sort of storms off and leaves him and sends him a text saying, never talk to me again. And he says to her that he's going to go back to England unless she gets back in touch with him. And she doesn't, and he's in the taxi going to the airport, and the telephone that he'd left in his apartment starts ringing, and the name flashes up, Sophia. And that's where the story ends. Well, probably a very disjointed way of saying the story, but that's pretty much the story up to that point of the end of the book of the Gans People Play.
I'm going to come to you first, Aidan. If some people, for whatever reason, have had technological issues there and have missed the beginning of this podcast and have come in halfway through Gary Shine, it just sounds like a real story that Gary just talks about normally when we're doing our regular podcast. listening to him there, that could have been any story about any football club, about any real life podcast that we were chatting about. But I guess that's, obviously Gary knows the story inside out and the characters, I don't know, Gary just explained it there like it was a real life. I was convinced it was a real life story.
Well, this is the thing. He does explain it that way. And I guess, in Gary's mind, we'll probably get onto this in terms of some of the process, but a lot of it is almost real. I don't know exactly how true that is, but when you're living with fictional characters, it's not anything I've ever experienced or had to work with or chosen to work with. But you do imagine that it becomes real in your mind. The incidents and the actual the people, the personalities and what happens. So yeah, the way he's explaining it, very much so. So I mean that's definitely something when we get into the process and how real it all is and whether Gary sees them as actual characters to some extent or how he can escape that world and delve back into it. That's all quite fascinating about this process because it's so far removed from everything else we do and everything I do. I mean, hats off to you, Gary, because there's no way I could even come up with concepts like this, let alone make them come alive to some extent and make it a readable venture at the end of it. You know, my English essays were always B minus C plus. That's not good enough, really, when it comes to publishing a book.
When I was listening back to the podcast, I did actually ask, well, both of you and Stephen in about whether or not you would ever consider writing fiction. And both of you absolutely said categorically no. And
then That has not changed.
And then I gave you the best part of an hour to come up with a fictional setting. But I guess so. That's what I was going to ask. A year down the line, that's not changed, Aidan, no?
Not a chance, no. it's hard enough writing about things that are real that you can research and have an opinion on. Coming up with a world of your own, I just think you need so much dialogue and things like that to make it come alive. Whereas in our world of the nonfiction, it's more about the description and scene setting and putting things in a place and time. And yeah, sure, you need elements of that in fiction as well. But it's the dialogue. There's so much dialogue that you have to have to really make it feel real. And to me, I would find that really, really difficult of making dialogue sound natural and making it read as natural and making the dialogue tell the story at certain points rather than the description. And that's what this kind of story needs. And goodness me, I couldn't do that.
Well, coming to a man who probably could, Stephen. So in terms of, no, there's no pressure. Football writing at the moment, or to me it seems anyway, whether that's just because of the world, as Aidan was saying, the world we normally inhabit, certainly on this podcast, print, books, you know, seems to be making a real sort of comeback, or there's a real resurgence to it. Do you think that, I'm not saying that football fiction has a place, because of course it has its place, but do you think that because of this resurgence in books and football books, there will also be, I suppose, an accompanying, albeit smaller, resurgence in either, you know, football fiction, or, you know, people will look to go down that route maybe more and more?
Oh, I'm sure. You know, we only have to look at, like, Jeff Goulden. You know, I believe he's working on a follow-up to his fiction-based football book. And, you know, I think it's one of these that, writers who take the plunge for it, you know, really, I mean, we know from writing, you know, what we write as factual stuff, that there's a certain kind of, I don't know, you get bitten by the bug, and, you know, once you've done one, you want to do the next one. You know, there's always something, and it's kind of like a secondary bug for those who seem to go into fiction writing as well, is that, you know, it's almost like being bitten twice. You know, I'm spotting that. Those who do fall into writing fiction, you know, can't get out of it. You know, the drawn in, you know, and I'm quite thankful that I follow Aidan in the fact that there is absolutely no way I could do this. But I'm so glad that Gary does, though.
I was just about to say, so it's
I am so
Gary
glad
to
that
fly
Gary
the
does.
Flag. Yeah. By proxy, we all write football fiction through you, Gary.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more likely to write a children's book than I would do. Right, I'm surrounded by children a lot of the time, so it's kind of like, yeah, I'm more likely to go down the route of kind of like, yeah, writing a children's book than a novel.
Okay, so we've established, Gary, that even a year after your debut novel, the three of us have absolutely zero intention of following in your footsteps, but clearly have absolutely great admiration for what you have done and then gone and done it again.
Well, I was going to say, Stu, is that definite for you as well? You know, me and Stephen have given our definite no's. Is this you ruling it out as well?
Oh, yes. Oh, I don't have the concentration span to keep threads running together. I would be lost within page six of who did what, which character was where and where they were supposed to be. Yeah, I would. The imagination is fine. It's the discipline that absolutely is.
No, I agree with that. My characters would change name partway through and stuff like that, and I'd completely forget about someone until kind of like the final chapter, thinking, oh, good God.
Yeah. 90 pages down and you've forgotten
about
one of the characters.
I've forgotten one of the main characters. I've not mentioned them since the eighth page. It's like,
They were probably laying injured on the pitch and they're still there.
Yeah, people reading it thinking, what happened to them? You know, they're on the back, in the back of an ambulance, where they are.
I am absolutely with you guys. Not a chance. So, like I say, Gary, thank God for you, is what I say. So the second book then, A Whole New Ball Game. Now, clearly, like we said, it's only been out at the time of recording one day. So there will be zero spoilers here. So I will leave it up to you as to how much information you are willing to part with in terms of book two.
Okay. Well, one of the things I forgot to mention when I was given that sort of pricey of the book was Charlie Broome's father, Bobby Broome, who owned the football club, and he owned a sort of a ceramics company in the UK, quite a large regional company. And part of the deal his son got involved with was to sell his father's business from underneath him without him knowing. So he was a nasty piece of work, was young Charlie Broome. And he was the villain of the story. And he's the only one of the main characters in the first book that doesn't really appear over much in the second book, but very, very briefly. But basically, there was a lot of loose ends, intention left. And Steve, when we spoke in the first podcast, Steve got a wonderful phrase he said about the ending leaving, it's like leaving a bit of toffee in your teeth. Now, that was really, that really summed it nicely, because there were lots of things left undone. And so this book, basically, I wanted to sort of gather up all the loose ends and tie them all together in a nice bow. So basically, it picks up from the story of when John Morton's driving away to the airport to leave retirement and fly back to England. But he changed his mind because one of the text messages that came through on Sophia's phone, Sophia's the girl who he was with, the coach of the club, before he got there, said that she was going to go and visit her former boyfriend and go back to him because he'd say he'd take her back and all this sort of thing. It transpired up actually that she hadn't sent the message. It was one of the players who was like a sort of like an uncle figure to her, trying to protect her. And he and John Morton basically decided he was going to find her. And so basically, to cut a long story short, they ended up getting back together, and all the club was sort of technically out of business. The local authority, local council, the Ayuntamiento here in Spain, it's called, was persuaded to try and get them a moratorium on the on their bankruptcy to survive the season. The company that was buying the business of Charlie Broome and the football club grounds called Ceramica International, and they bought Bobby Broome's company as well. That was the other sort of part of the deal. And they weren't really bad people. They were just in business. And they sort of saw a benefit in allowing the club to try and survive. And that could be portrayed as the good guys with good publicity. And the story basically goes on about how they try to survive. And they get an investment from, there's a chain of restaurants in my fictional world called Bella Cucina, which is like an Italian restaurant chain. And they basically get the guy who owns that chain, it's an international chain, to invest in the club, which he does, provide with a bond so they can play the season, but on the proviso that his son plays. And his son was a former player at Milan, and you know, they started playing really well, and then things sort of go awry. And basically, Bobby Broome, when Billy Swan went back to the UK, he sort of betrayed his friends. He was a broken character, and basically Bobby Broome picks him up and gives him a reason for living again through a sort of like a charitable organisation. And everybody's saying, oh, you've got to get friends with John Morton, you've got to get friends with him again. And Billy Swan comes back to Spain and to sort of rescue the situation. The story goes towards the end of the season, it comes to another playoff, and are they going to get there or not? Well, I can't give the ending away, but that's pretty much the story. And I developed some of the characters from the first book. Like Bobby Broome is far more important in this second book than he was in the first book. One of the main characters, and some of the players, and there's a love interest for Billy Swan, and things develop between John Morton and Sofia Garrigues. It's really the second half of the story that I always had in mind if I was going to do a sequel. I can't get the ending away, but that's pretty much how the story goes. And this story goes through the season, as it did with the first book, and there's ups and downs, and there's things that work out and things that don't work out, and a couple of new characters involved. Yeah, so it's I like to think it's a sort of it's not a rehash of the previous story. It's a continuation of the previous story.
I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, obviously the character there, it's another football season, but yeah, for me, it's a definite continuation. Aidan, like Gary said before, that you know the book one ends with that phone, that flipping phone, ringing on the table that we had to wait a year for. I don't know. This is a daft question to ask, but were you pleased that Gary sort of addressed all the toffee in the teeth, as Stephen called it?
Let's be honest. If that hadn't been addressed, we'd all have felt a little bit shortchanged because we needed to know what happened. That was a crucial thing. So yeah, absolutely. Goodness me. I mean, you leave on a cliffhanger like that, then you have to have some sort of resolution to it, one way or another. I don't want to. Gary's told the story. I'm not going to go and add any details from the story that he hasn't shared, but absolutely. But I mean, that's where we all said at the time, because it ended on that cliffhanger, there had to be a sequel, didn't there? There had to be more. Now, Gary interestingly described it as the second half, but you know, wonder if there's going to be extra time as well. That's another question to come later on, perhaps. But yeah, exactly. It was set up perfectly for a follow-up. And again, it neatly fits around a season in the football calendar as well. And that's a sort of the base to it all. You know, all the other action goes on top of that, but it's all based in a football season and the fortunes, positive and negative, of Retama and how they're getting on. And that sort of grounds it all as the story goes through. So yes, this phone was ringing over the summer break, of course. So gladly, before the season started, something happened about that.
It did, which I was very excited for when our copy arrived. You know, Stephen, I guess it's, I mean, Gary has now written about two full seasons in Spanish football. And, you know, as we talked about in the first podcast with this, it's not about, and Gary made a point about not wanting it to be a descriptive, they won then and they drew then and they scored that type of goal. It's quite difficult to write about action, if that makes sense, football action, without it being repetitive. And yet we've now got two full seasons and the best part of 500 plus pages, and it never feels like it's repetitive.
Not at all. Not in the slightest. Which is just an amazing thing to be able to do. I'm just full of admiration for it. You know, I think for me it's the way that the story rolls on, and as Gary said, it's the continuation of, you know, the first part of this story as well. You know, this isn't, you know, a tribute act to the first book. It is just it's the elongating of a fantastic story. And you know, as the games go on, I think you mentioned it in the first podcast doing the first book, the first of the novels, is that you just want to know what happens next to the team. You know, and to see how they're going. I mean, I know at some point I'm going to start, looking up on the internet to see what the latest results are. You know, completely lapsing into thinking that they're a real football team. You know, and then that's the great thing about it is that, you know, Gary makes it so relatable. You know, all of the football references are great ones. You know, they're also very, very kind of like, it isn't comic book in any way. You know, that's the great thing. You never lapse once into comic book kind of, you know, vernacular or anything like that. You know, there is no breaking of the crossbar. There is no, you know, it isn't Roy of the Rovers stuff. You know, there is the realistic side of football in there as well. You know, there's the peaks and the troughs, and it's utterly realistic, and it's just a magnificently put together piece of work.
It truly is. It truly is. And I have to say, Gary, that stadium, I can still see it. Even before, when the book, I still knew what that stadium looks like. I still know, as Stephen said, when he's looking for the results, and I'm actually in Spain looking for the ground, I'll know it when I see it. So going back to a point that Aidan made, you know, you, it's like the second half of the story. When you very first came up with this concept, this idea, these characters, was this always the full story, or was the full story somewhere short and it got added to, or was this always the end game? Was it always a 2-season long story?
No, not always. It was towards the end. And it's interesting what Steve was saying about having the double bug. Right. Towards the end of the story, I knew it was going to, I think I mentioned in the first podcast that I wrote the last chapter first, because I wanted to know where I was going to. And I was getting towards the sort of, I don't know, last 2 or 3 chapters before the, and I was thinking, I really like the ending, but I didn't want to leave it like that. So towards the sort of the last 20% of the book, I got this thing, well, I could pick this up, actually, I could do something from here. So not always, but sort of midway, 3/4 way through the book, I did have that sort of idea of how to pick the story up and how to, make it. I would say make it complete. That's not really what I mean. Pull the toffee out of the teeth, to use Steve's metaphor.
I don't quite know how to word this bit, but sometimes when films are made, let's go with Back to the Future. So Back to the Future Part 2 and 3 were made back to back. They were just made back to back, and they were done as one. Did you have a gap between book 1 and book 2, or was it just a continuation as you were going through it?
No, there was a gap. It was about because I was finished off the Dutch book in between, so that sort of fell in between. I wasn't writing the novel and the Dutch book at the same time, but there was that sort of a little bit of an overlap there. So there was a gap, and I suppose that was quite handy in as much as it gave me time to sort of formulate the story better, make a few notes and change a few notes and as to what I was going to do. And the fate of Bobby Broom in the end was never in my mind. That came halfway through writing this, and I thought it worked well in relation to Billy Swan and what happened with him in the book. But that I hadn't got that in my mind. It just felt the way to do it. In fact, I had a couple of conversations with the publishers, and that was one of the things we sort of had not a disagreement about, but we said, well, what about doing it this way, that way? Once I got it right, though, I thought, no, that really worked well. So that was something that came sort of on the hoof, as it were, halfway through, and the development of his character, who is quite sort of very central in the book.
I knew I'd have loads of questions. I'm really sorry. So what's it like? Are you sat in your apartment on the balcony, and all of a sudden you think, oh, I'm going to do that? Or is it where you think about it and you go, I'll just give that some time, because I know how impatient I am. I'd have been like, brilliant idea, and written it regardless. I know how impatient I am. Are you someone who can have a good idea but then just wait and think, I'll come back to that in a couple of days' time and see if I still agree?
No, I think the first one, I think it hit me sort of pretty quickly, in as much as I was looking away emotionalise Billy Swan. And that just seemed a good way of doing it. I tried 2 or 3 different ways, but when I thought, well, actually, I could do that, and because he was sort of a fairly he was probably the purest character, Bobby Broom, in both books, aside from John and Sophia, and it just seemed like a right way of doing it. I said before, in the best stories, the heroes always die. And it just works. But it did come to me, I wouldn't say in a flash, but fairly, oh God, actually, yeah, do that. That would work. So yeah, fairly quickly.
So Aidan, coming to you. Obviously you and I have only written one book. Gary and Stephen just seem to write books for fun. How would you feel about writing a fiction book and a factual book at the same time?
This reminds me of Steven Spielberg. Didn't he make Jurassic Park and Schindler's List in the same year? And now that seems to be going from one extreme to the other.
Now there's a crossover. There's going to be kind of like all sorts of stuff going. If I did that, there'd be dinosaurs, all in the wrong places, all over the place.
The World War might have gone differently if there'd been a T-Rex there.
Yeah, completely.
But that's the kind of thing. That's one total extreme to the other. How his mind got through that, I never know. But that's what... slightly different scale, sure. But, you know, that's the kind of difference in concept you're talking about. So going from the 1970s cool and swagger of the Dutch to then going to contemporary Spain, lower league football and people and their issues and all of that kind of stuff. That's a kind of leap I couldn't make in my mind. I find it hard enough, talking about our own writing processes, going from being in the midst of a chapter of a book and then we're doing a magazine around the same time. And, you know, you kind of have to build time for both. But I simply can't do that until one of them is finished. You know, I'll put back the magazine bit until I've finished a chapter or vice versa. You know, I can't sort of jump between the two, even though I kind of know that both need doing around the same time. And that's really hard. And that's just on smaller themes, you know. It isn't, I don't have the narrative story arc weaving through the whole thing like you have to have in a fiction book. It's that kind of thing. I think possibly to my mind, and Gary, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the fiction one seems like it would be a harder thing to jump out of than the Dutch one that you were doing around the same time, because that's obviously based in truth, reality, and things that you're familiar with, things you know about, or things you can easily research about, whereas the other one is entirely in your head and nowhere else. And therefore, it seems to me that sort of stepping out of that to do the other one seems a hard leap.
I didn't find it that difficult. I mean, when I'm in retirement of the world, it's almost like I can pull a cloak over me and I can just be in that world. I don't know, but it's just the way my brain works, but I didn't find that difficult.
Getting back, were you writing bits of both at around the same time though? I know you said it kind of crossed over a bit, so were you actually going from a chapter of the fiction book to a chapter of the Dutch book and back? Wow.
Not possibly, but yes, at times I was. Yeah. And I mean, it is easier to go. It was easier to go from The Bridesmaids to retirement, as I said, because I can get in the world, and I mean I can be in that world because it's in my head. But coming back it was more difficult, because then you've got to exist in reality there, and it's not the world where you create, so nobody can say you're wrong because it's my world and I know what's going on there, nobody else does. So that was I found that easier. And so switching from the Dutch book to the novel was easier than the other way around. But I didn't find it too difficult, to be honest with you. So I could just my mind, I'm there now. I'm in retirement. Weird, strange, but perhaps that's just me.
How does it feel to be the Steven Spielberg of these football times, Gary? It's quite the accolade.
I've been called many things in my life, but never the Steven Spielberg of football writing.
Which book is Jurassic Park? I guess it's got to be the fictional one, because the other one's based in reality. That's, so the Dutch have to be Schindler's List.
Yeah,
don't they?
I think so. Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. Yeah.
Billy Swan is the T-Rex.
Yeah. Well, yes. Billy Swan is the T-Rex. Yeah. No, Charlie Brewer would be the T-Rex, I think, wouldn't he? But Billy Swan would be the Velociraptor, perhaps.
I can't believe we've gone down a dinosaur.
Where have we gone? I know.
Stephen, I know you started a book and then wrote three and have now gone back to the first book that you started. How do you find jumping to and from, like Aidan was saying, you know, with magazines and books, how do you find switching from one focus to another?
I mean, not too bad. I mean, at least with the magazines that we write, the kind of the style of writing, the approach to the articles is similar to how I write a book. You know, it's like I always said that writing a book is like writing the biggest article of your life. And, you know, in that respect, it's, you know, we write these articles for the magazine and they're like small short stories, almost like a short story know, book form of some description. So it's not too difficult to do. What I find more difficult to do is, the alter ego who writes for This Is Anfield, which is just very kind of like, you know, everything's contemporary. It's what's happened right now. You know, it's you know, sitting down and writing about something that I've just watched like a couple of hours ago. That's very, very different. That's more difficult to switch back from, to write contemporary and then historical, contemporary, historical. That's much more difficult thing to do than swapping between two historical pieces that you're writing. So if I'm writing kind of like for the magazine, it's quite easy to slip back into writing to, you know, the book. But yeah, writing, you know, an observational comment piece on a football match, or, you know, some kind of football incident that's happened, you know, a big football story, and then going back to writing about, you know, football that happened 35 years ago, that's a little bit of a trickier thing to do.
I think I can just say exactly what Steve's saying there, because I think if I was doing the Dutch book, and I've got a book coming out at Chelsea next year, if I was switching between those two, I think that'd be much more difficult. But you know, when you sort of difference between a factual book and something that's in your mind, you know, and it only exists in your mind, so it doesn't really matter almost what you say. But that was easier. I mean, I couldn't switch between two books, two factual books. I mean, that would be, you lose the theme. But these two, it's like saying, you know, can you sort of, you know, do cooking and do housework at the same time, swap between the two, because they're different. So yeah, I think I probably could. Could you cook two different meals at the same time? Well, probably not, because they're two, it's the same thing, but it's different. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't explain that very well, but yeah.
That's a great analogy. I like that. I can run with that analogy. The second book, obviously a lot of the characters are already there. You know, you established them in the first book, and again, going back to the first podcast, I made a note. 28 characters you introduced in book one, and expanded all bar two was how you worded it. It's not about the number of new characters. That's not what I'm interested in. What I'm interested in is how or what was the process of bringing new characters in? Did you consider the characters who were already there? Obviously, the story has to be considered. But the makeup of the character, did you have to consider the characters that were already in place, or did you just have an idea of the character and think, well, this person's coming into this story no matter what?
Good question. I need another villain. So I had to get another villain in there, you know, the sort of person that you think, oh, this guy's great, and then actually not so much in the end. So there was a need for that. So that was a requirement. So I was looking to put a pavilion there. But some of the other characters were really just necessary foils for what was already in there. Like, for instance, I mean, the fate of Revy's grandmother was a way of me making him a bigger character, because he was a sort of fairly minor character in the first book, and I might touch on Revy a bit later. But there were certain characters, and I wanted to keep the team fresh, so I brought a couple of other players into it as well, and how they came together. And I made the company, Ceramica International, they looked like the bad guys. And we said something in the first podcast that nobody's all bad, nobody's all good, and they looked like bad guys, but they weren't really that bad. They were just doing what they do. They were business doing what businesses do. So yeah, there was a need for some characters, but also I wanted to freshen the team. I want to rotate my squad, as it were. So I took a few players out who sort of disappeared for various reasons, like Santi, for example. One of the new players who came in wasn't there very long, because that happens. And you know, if you have, you know, I don't know, a squad of 16 to 17 players and nobody comes in and nobody goes out across two seasons, it's just unrealistic. So I just needed to do that and to make a few changes to make it a bit more believable.
So I'm really sorry again. I'm not sure how to word this. So what came first then? in the book too? Was it the new characters and then you made the story fit around them, or was it the continuation of the story and then you had to create characters that would fit into that story?
I think the second one, really, because I wanted a way of, the club was in financial shtuck and I wanted a way of getting them out of it. And it was too easy to say, oh, they've won the lottery or something. It was just unrealistic. So I had to get somebody to come in and provide the money, but with a bite in the tail, as it were. So I think, the genesis of the story was first, really. Then I sort of hung the characters on the line that I created.
In terms of new characters, Aidan, did you have a particular favourite with the new or the added cast of characters that were introduced? I mean, all I can relate it to is like when the Emperor arrives in The Empire Strikes Back. You don't see him in Star Wars, but you do see him in The Empire Strikes Back, and he becomes quite important. In terms of new characters, obviously there's a couple that play massive parts, but did you have a particular new favourite character?
Depends how you define favourite. Favourite in a sort of love to hate kind of a way. And you know, story needs all of that, don't they? But we were talking on a pod recently about Maverick players on Flamengo pod, wasn't it? We talked about love of Maverick players and people who do the unpredictable but have a bit of an attitude to go with it. So I like the Italian intervention in this story, who came along to the team, didn't stay long, did some good things, but had a mega bad attitude and, you know, didn't always work out that well. But that's an interesting character. So I liked him for all the fact that he's not exactly one that you're meant to love in terms of the story or in terms of harmony in the squad. But he was an interesting character, and that's all for the better. And especially when it comes to a fictional story, you need a little bit of that. You need people to hate. You need people to rail against, and to sort of, well, think, well, what on earth are they going to do? What's going to happen here? What's going to happen next? What are they going to spoil? That's what you need, and that's why you love that kind of character. But in terms of the playing side of things, that's what I like as well. Bit of an attitude, bit of a bad boy.
I remember now, you are the Romario of these football fans. I remember where that discussion went. Stephen, again, you know, fiction writing is all about, you know, if it's done well, you either care about the characters, or as Aidan's just said there, you want to read about them. You're excited when they happen to be on the page or when they're in the chapter. And that can only be done through quality writing. You can't half do it, or you can't just leave it up to the reader to imagine what they're like. You know, that depth has to be in there if you're going to either care about them or have an interest in them.
Yeah, you've got to get that sense of personality over. To make them relatable, you know, that's the good and the bad. You know, we were all being in kind of like, I don't know, social settings or working environments or places of education where we've seen all of those types of personality, the good, the bad, the ugly, and everything in between. And this is what's so good about, you know, fiction writing and the way that Gary's approached this book. He gets the personality traits and the quirks, you know, brilliantly in the, you know, and as Aidan says, you know, the character that he was discussing there, you know, he's a character that I don't know, he is the villain, but he is also, you know, there's part of it that makes you want to plug for him, that he's actually going to come good. Sure, he will in the third book. I'm putting it out there, he'll come good in the third book. But yes, you know, this is the way it, you know, that the great fiction writers can do it. You know, they make you believe in these characters, and you know, the flaws and everything in between. You know, all of the plus points, all the negatives, because we all have them. You know, but they all work on a sliding scale. You know, no one's perfect, and no one's, you know, complete write off in most respects. And Gary kind of like nails the characters so well, because, you know, there'll be certain characters you think, I've worked with someone like that. I know someone like that, you know, and it's just brilliant as you trick through them and you tick every single box and every single personality, and you think, yep, absolutely fantastic. You know, and it's just a joy to behold.
When you were chatting earlier, Gary, you know, and Aidan asked the question about how difficult it was to come out of the world and write about the Dutch, and then go back in. You know, and you talked about how you just sit there and sort of pull this cloak over, and you're in that world. Do you still pull the cloak over and go back into that world, even though the book's finished? Do you still find yourself going back to the club and thinking about them as, I mean, as real? Well, yeah, I do, actually. Thinking about them as real people and what they are now doing.
Yeah, I do. It's terrible, isn't it, really? I remember we did the first podcast and you asked the guys a similar question, and I mentioned Esteban. the old guy at the ground, and I wanted, in my mind, when I did in the first book, he was just an old guy. But there's a big thing in SpongeBob, especially smaller clubs, that and we were speaking with Pete Watson at their clubs in Latin America, South America, and they had the importance they have to the barrio, the neighborhood of where they are. And I wanted to make in this book, I wanted to make Esteban an everyman character for the neighborhood where the location was. He's the only fan of the club that's ever really mentioned, but he is sort of his desire for the club, his disappointment, his joy, when the success and his hopes, aspirations are an everyman manifestation of all the fans of the club. And in this book, because I've developed more of the characters, I've developed some of the main characters more. Yeah, they have become real, and yeah, I know where they are. Because I mean, you know, as I said in the first book, the flat, the apartment that John lives in is my apartment, but they moved over the road now. They moved over the road, and I do look through the kitchen window, and I know it's crazy. It's crazy. And there's actually nobody in there. It actually belongs to a family from San Sebastian in the Basque Country. They're not here very often. And I do look and I think, John, it's crazy, I know. But they do become, it's difficult because when they, you know, if I put these two books together, they've probably taken me, 18 months to write the pair of them. That's a big chunk. That's a big chunk of concentration in creating something. That you can't always sort of, you know, okay, you have to put that now, put it away. Because they become too real. It's like Stevie says about, you know, developing the characteristics and the characters, the flaws and the things, and they do become real. I know now. I mean, you could say, you know, if any of the 10 main characters, or I don't know, main characters, there are 12 perhaps, something happened to them, like, you know, somebody collapsed in the street, I think I'd know how they'd react. Do you know what I mean? I mean, because I've got their characters so defined in my brain now. It's terrible, isn't it? It's terrible. It's become a bit obsessive, I guess.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Actually, is how, you know, when, I mean, I don't know. The only thing I can think of is when people go into acting roles and they live the role, yeah, even outside of the, you know, method acting.
Yeah.
Are you a method writer? I don't know if that's a thing.
I've never thought of it before, but I guess I suppose I am, really. Yeah, they are. I mean, I've got lots of friends who I know, or people that I know, and if they saw somebody collapse in the street, I know it, they'd react. But I know these characters would react as well. So I suppose to some extent, yeah. I mean, I never thought about it like that before, but yeah, yeah. It's the only way you can, especially when you've written two books. I mean, you know, one, okay, but two, you invested a lot of time's not the thing, really. You invested a lot of, I wouldn't say creativity, that sounds too pompous, but it's sort of that sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? You've made these people up, you've made them exist, you've given them a reality, even though it's not a real reality. You've given them sort of a life inside your head, and that's how they do exist to me, yeah. Crazy, isn't it? Crazy, yeah.
Well, no, because I'm going to ask you one more question before I go back to the guys. Do you find yourself, when you're in that world, do you find yourself thinking about where they could go? I mean, I know we're going to talk about a book three, clearly, and it's already been hinted at. But do you find yourself either thinking about where the story could go and you're like, no, stop it, because if I think about it, I'll have to write it? Or do you actually let yourself go and think about where they either where they could be or where they could go?
I didn't do so much this in this the second book. In both the books, I planned the season out. I've got an Excel spreadsheet. I've got an Excel spreadsheet for how many games each player played and how many goals are scored and when they scored and the minutes they scored. Both books were planned out. I did not write the last chapter first, was strange enough. And I didn't, when I got towards the end of this one, perhaps because I did it a different way, get to thinking, what's next? I didn't really do that with the second one. I don't know whether it's because I approached it differently, I don't know, or whether it just felt like, as I said earlier, you know, you get all the loose ends, you tie them all together and they're a nice little bow and there you are, it's done now. I mean, I don't know. No, I didn't really think about it.
I'll come to you, Aidan. Obviously, I mean, we've not lived it like Gary's lived it. I mean, clearly this world exists for Gary. And obviously we've read the book relatively recently. So I do find myself thinking about them. I'm so obsessed with the stadium. I can't tell you how obsessed I am with the stadium. But in terms of, you know, obviously we've read it. Do you, even though it's not your book, Aidan, I'm not for a minute thinking you would, but do you find yourself thinking about where these characters could go or where you would like to see them go?
Yeah, to some extent. And that's a sign of a fiction book that's kind of wormed its way into your consciousness a little bit, hasn't it? But it goes beyond that as well, because as Stephen alluded to before, you're thinking about the football team and thinking about where they go as well. And that, you know, as paths diverge, that doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as where the characters go, does it? You know, things could change over time. Maybe Billy Swan will become the new John Morton as the coach. You never know, further down the line. It's all these kind of things that might happen to the club. How are they going to cope in future seasons? And what's going to happen next for them? And which of these characters that we've grown to know and love in some cases, hate in others, how are they going to be part of that story? Or how are they going to move on? Or what quirks of fate are going to befall some of them? All that kind of stuff. It does worm its way into your consciousness. And that's what good fiction does. It does leave you thinking about it. It does make you wonder what happens next. But that's how things sometimes should leave it, or at least each book. That's not to say there shouldn't be a third. Sure, Gary, we need to know what happens next as well. But each separate book needs to leave you thinking what comes next. Otherwise, it is, I know Gary mentioned it, things can be neatly wrapped up, but there's always other strands that aren't necessarily. There's always something else that you can think about that might happen. So, yeah, this is me saying, Gary, write the next one. Get on with it. I don't know why you're waiting.
I think he probably already has started. He's just going to tell us.
I know. He says he's writing a Chelsea book, but really, you know, he's writing episode 3 of this one as well. Return Stephen, of the Italians. That's what it'll
exactly.
be.
Stephen, you're a big, massive fan of Star Wars. You know, we love the spin-off series. So if there had to be a spin-off book written by Gary, which character would you like to see get their own spin-off? We could maybe tempt Gary that way.
That's a good one. But, I mean, yeah. I think I'd like an Esteban prequel.
Oh,
The Retama of the 60s or something like that. Yeah, I'd like that.
I'm going to ask you the same question, I think, Aidan, because I really like that question that I just made up. any particular character you would like in a spin-off book? Because at the moment we've got Gary writing part 3 and one spin-off. We might as well give him another.
Yeah, well, I do like that Esteban idea. I would like to see that. So, yeah, there's another one for you, Gary. Get on with that when you've got a spare moment. But I think I'll have to go with the Maverick characters. So, There's two of them. There's two key ones in this one. Obviously, Billy Swan has been throughout. He's got a bit of that edge. He's got the quality to go with it as well. So I think there's much more to his story. perhaps it could be a prequel, I guess, but equally it could be what happens next specifically for him. He could go off in a different direction to some of the other characters, perhaps. And the other one is, of course, my Italian friend. So, you know, I think he's got more stories to tell.
Are we helping, Gary, by any... Are we helping you in any way?
I think we're making it worse.
I think so, yeah.
I think we're adding to the inbox, to the in-tray, onto the extending that to-do list, which is great.
I mean, the Chelsea book is actually done. It's finished. But I'm working on the Ajax book at the moment. That's the one I'm working on at the moment, which I've probably got another 6 months to go on that one. I mean, I didn't think about extending the story, because I mean, continuing the story when I was writing it. But I finished it a couple of months ago now, I suppose, 6-7 weeks ago. But they keep knocking on my head. They keep knocking on the door in my head, and you know, there's some, and I've sort of semi got an idea. But I don't know.
You've sounds like it. A yes to me.
You've said it on the podcast. That is not being taken out or deleted.
It's I don't know. We'll see. I mean,
it's time stamped.
It would. I mean, there was one character that a new character that I bought into this story, the second book, which I think has got potential to Del Hart. But I thought I really like Del Hart. Actually, it was really weird, and I mentioned this in the first book. None of the characters really based on anybody, particularly, other than a couple. But I've got this in my mind about this Del Hart and what he would look like. And I know who he was. I didn't know it at the time, but the guy, he died quite recently. It was Frank Burrows, who used to manage briefly West Bromwich Albion. And it must have been sort of subconsciously, he used to do that. He had a flat cap. Always wore a flat cap and a tracksuit top. And I didn't know until I saw a picture of him when he died quite recently. I thought, bloody hell, it's Del Hart. But he might, I mean, he might, I don't know, we'll see.
He's the name written on my piece of paper, Del Hart. I thought he was brilliant. I really liked him.
Yeah.
Okay, so
I'd just jump in there. Is Gary's description of what Del Hart looks like in my world, in my version of it, he's Malcolm Allison with a big order. I think Stu was going to come to it. Shaw saw it on his list about kind of like the images of, and that's the great thing about the written word, the written fiction word is that. You know, it's a bit like listening to someone on the radio and not knowing what they look like. You know, and you conjure up an image in your head. And you know, anyone who reads this book, any kind of fiction book, will have their own mental images of the characters.
Yeah.
And, you know, but how they diverge from person to person is fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting because I most of the characters I try to avoid physical descriptions of them for that very reason, Steve, because it allows people to have them their own personal ownership of what a character. And the same with the games. I didn't want to say too much about so and so gets the ball, we pass it to so and so, because it just sounds too laboured. And people, if you're fairly brief with the description, people can fill in all the spaces in their own imagination themselves.
Is there, because that Stephen's right, that is one of the questions I was going to come to next. Is there, so in the early drafts, so way back whenever you started, was it about 4 years ago you started thinking about this?
Yeah, there must be, yeah.
Yeah. Obviously now the world in your head must be so rich and so detailed compared to how it was in those early thoughts. But is it how you imagined it in those early thoughts, or has it changed and shifted in any way?
God, that's a good question, Stu. I don't know is a short answer, I guess. Because some of the players, I sort of fell into their character. Like, for instance, in the first book, Kiko and Victor, I just gave them names. And it's only afterwards I thought, oh, when this one turns up that he starts calling Victor Meldrew, and he starts calling Kiko Kiki D, and then the song came from that. And that was just a lucky accident, because I'm now in the play. I was looking for Spanish names for players. So some changed a bit, I suppose. I think the world in my head hasn't changed that much, but it got a little bit richer, shall we say, as you develop some of the characters. And as I said, the two I didn't do last time, I sort of built those up a bit more this time. Revy being a sort of a big example. I suppose it's got a little bit fuller rather than more than different, shall we say.
That is how I hoped you would say. I hoped it was not different from how you imagined it. I hoped it was just a bit more coloured in. One thing that you did that was really interesting, and that was put your book cover up for a poll on Twitter. Again, very revolutionary. Aidan would like it. It's quite a maverick thing to do. What made you come up with that? By the way, the right one was chosen. But what made you come up with that idea? Or more to the point, how did you get the publishers to allow you to come up
with
that idea?
Well, interestingly, I used to run a graphic design agency when I was back in the UK. And so I know a few designers. One of the guys who I sort of worked with quite recently, towards the sort of end of time there, he's a first-class designer, and he designed the covers. But basically, in the first book and the second book, I just told him what I was sort of looking for, and he gave me some images, and then we cropped them from there. And the guy with the carrying the balls over his shoulder, as soon as I thought, that's brilliant, because it's a morning shot, and the back cover is an evening shot. It's a day. So that worked really well for me. But when I sent it to the publishers, he said, I don't like this. It doesn't represent the story. I can't remember what phrase it was, but which is, you know, it's artistic difference. And he came up with a couple of options. The one was that he preferred was like the silhouette one, if you recall. And we had some discussion and various, and it was his idea to go for the poll, basically. He said, well, let's and it's going to be a potential promo for the book. Let's see what people think. And the one I wanted, excuse me, I think got 78% of the votes, and the one he wanted got 4%. So I got the one I wanted in the end, because I mean, it was everybody. I think only one or two people voted for his, but that's how he came back. It was his idea, basically, not mine. I mean, he's got more. I mean, publishers are sort of more marketing orientated than I am. So that was his idea. Yeah. But I was dead to chose the right one.
It's quite the risk, though, isn't it? Allowing, like you said, the one you wanted, that could have quite easily gone.
Well,
it could have gone anyway.
He said, his publishing company, you know, they produce lots of books. And so you have to listen to the experts, you know, and he said, you know, it doesn't look like Spain, which I thought, okay, perhaps it doesn't. It looks like a cool English morning with a mist. And he said it doesn't portray the story. Oh, okay. And he sort of semi-convinced me to change it. And we discussed it a bit. But as I say, it was his idea to go to the poll. So I said, yeah, okay, that's fair enough. So that's what we did.
Aidan, would you ever consider putting a book cover to a poll?
I don't know if I'm brave enough for that. But then I don't have clear fixed ideas for that kind of thing. You know, we've been over recent weeks or the last month or two been looking at the cover for the one I've got next year, and my ideas that I passed over for that were so simplistic and I don't know, primary school kind of things compared to the kind of the stuff they can actually design. I just didn't have a clue what would look good or how to describe it or how things should be laid out. So I think I would end up just being totally swayed by whatever the publisher had said. And in this case, that would have meant a different cover for Gary's book, because that's what I would have just bowed to the greater knowledge that they should have, as Gary's saying, you know, they know what sells, or they know what they're looking for in this kind of thing. But that's not to say that it's necessarily the right fit or the most popular or the one that might appeal to a certain group of people. Maybe they know more aspects of a market overall, but maybe they don't know the niche market that we're talking about in some cases. I wouldn't be that brave, no, because I'd be so confused and so clueless about what I would actually want the design to look like that I would just go with the one that the publisher sent out. And I think, yeah, that's good. And the one that they did for me, which, you know, the world hasn't seen yet, even though you guys have, there was only one little tweak I've done to that. But that was just a color thing. It came out with a certain color scheme that said one thing to me, and that didn't encompass the overall. So I kind of get what's being said about what, you know, the cover has to encompass it a little bit rather than just be one aspect of it or something that maybe doesn't explain the story. But in this case, I think, because there's so many strands to the story, it doesn't have to look like it's a field in Spain. You know, I'm sure you have mist in Spain as well, Gary. I think this happens, you know, and a man walking off a training field or a pitch with a bag of balls, that's universal. The actual location of it is by the by. It's universal, and that will draw people in and appeal. But yeah, well, as clearly shown by the result there, you know, that was obviously a popular one, and it's good that you got to go with the one you wanted in the end, Gary. So it all worked out well. But no, I wouldn't be so brave. But my ideas of what to show on a cover, the artistry side of it, I can waffle on all day about artistry on a football field when it's others displaying it. When it comes to me having to show my artistic credentials, not a chance. So I passed over very simplistic ideas about the cover for my book. They came out with something that looks great, but it was nothing to do with any of the ideas I suggested.
Stephen, obviously, you know, we know you've had your trilogy of books, and you know, there was a slight theme that ran through your three book covers, but I don't even know if we've said what your next book is in a podcast yet, have we?
I can't remember, to be honest, but it's
Jurassic not, Park meets
it is it's dinosaur football, bit like
that's right, on the moon.
Yeah, a bit like on Top Gear where they all kind of like playing football with cars and stuff like that. This is heavily based on dinosaurs. It's the Jurassic period, and you know, it wasn't the Chinese that invented football. It was no way it was the British. No, it was the dinosaurs.
But in terms of book covers, then, for your Brontosauruses versus the T-Rexes that you're writing about,
yep.
In terms of your next book cover, obviously, I guess you've got another, I suppose, a free hit now at a book cover, but you're now three books in. You know, like when it's your first book, you just go, yeah, that's great. You know far more than I do. Gary's written more than one, and he's now been brave enough to go to the polls. How are you feeling about, I suppose, like I say, a complete free hitter book cover where you're not having to think about the previous one or the previous two that form part of the series?
Well, that makes it a little bit more, I don't know, a little bit more seat of the pants, really, because you know, the three books have all, I don't know, been led by one another. So as soon as the first cover was dreamt up, and it was a simple case of, you know, that's a great, I wanted it to be that specific game. And you know, there's you know, an electronic scoreboard, there is an Adidas Tango, you know, iconic pitch, and a, you know, iconic set of football kits, and it just utterly looked the part. You know, virtually empty stadium, you know, it was everything I wanted it to be. And as soon as kind of like that had happened, then you know, I'd seen the image of the 81 UEFA Cup final, and I thought, it's another goal scoring image. It's another iconic ball. It looks the part. No, but instead of behind the goal, it was a picture taken from the left hand side. And as soon as you'd done that, that was it. Then OCD kicks in, and then the third one had to be, well, it's going to have to be a goal scoring image, and it's going to have to be from the right hand side of the goal. And luckily enough, there was a perfect one, and it was Johnny Rep scoring in the 73 European Cup final. And there's Dino's off trying to keep the ball out of the back of the net. And the ball's, you know, a Telstar. So, you know, absolutely everything fell into place for those three books. So the fourth book comes along and you're thinking, well, I don't really want to do what I've done before. But at the same time, I know more of what I don't want to do. than what I do want to do. So this one's proving a little bit more of a sticking point. But I think with three books down the line, I've earned my right to be a little bit of a diva over it, and to be a little bit of a little bit indecisive.
I like that.
It's interesting with the Beautiful Horizon Minds book. I'm sure we've all dealt with the guy at Pitch who does the cover designs, Duncan. And, he went with my idea for that front cover, back cover, and the inside because of the end plates or something. But the Chelsea book, he said, oh, I've got a better idea, and he was right. So, I mean, although I sort of chose the first one, he sort of convinced me to change the second one. He was right, nobody just looks better. But covers are such an important thing, because the only thing you can't sell the inside story, because people can't see it. The first thing they see is either the title of the book, the cover, or the author's name. That's it. That's what you see. And you've got to pick it up from there to open up and see what's inside. So covers are so important, as is the title of books.
Yeah, that's something else. That could be a whole other podcast. Yeah. That covers the image, the middle images, titles, spines, fonts, all of that. Yeah. That could be a podcast all by itself.
I wouldn't mind, but I've got a book planned for 2025 already. I've no books planned for 2023 or 2024, but I've got a book planned for 2025, and I already know what the cover I want as the cover. So I'm far more decisive for a book that's 4 years away than I am for the one that's next year.
That sounds a lot like your podcast arrival habits, if I'm being honest. that probably just sums up your podcast arrival habit in book cover choices. Guys, like I say, we're sort of nearly an hour and 15 already. Gary, I suppose we can't. We've danced around it. We've kind of asked. You've hinted. There's all sorts gone on. I am going to have to ask you categorically before this finishes. Will there be a third book?
I'm not sure. Is the honest answer. I'm not sure. When I finished the Ajax one, that'll be seven. And I'm just thinking. I don't know. You know, seven's an awful lot of books. I don't know. Every time I speak to somebody about it, or speak to the wife about it, you know, she says, you're going to do it. So, I mean, I'd rather say no, I'm not sure, and then go and do it, rather than say I'm going to do it and then really sort of not want to. I think when I finish the Ajax book that I work at the moment, your life gets pretty empty very quickly afterwards. It sounds strange, but it does. It's that book. I probably will.
Brilliant. I knew if we kept this on long enough, we'd get an answer at the end. Okay, so now we know. I can ask another question now. Have you got a rough, and I'm not asking for any, I'm just asking for a yes, no here. Have you got a rough idea of where it would go?
Yeah, I've got two or three alternatives.
Yeah. Brilliant. Book's coming. Great. That's all we needed.
You can't not. But it's like you were saying earlier, you know, that there's such a part of me now, and I can't sort of, it's like locking out a part of your life. So, you know, I don't know. I probably will, but I don't know.
Like I say, you must live with them. You must live with them all the time. Right. My last question for you, Gary.
Right.
And I know in the podcast, you talked about looking at random images on Google to give faces to the character, so you know what you're picturing. But I don't know. To me, I've written here, which I sent out to you guys. Would you ever consider? Either paying an artist or asking an artist to draw.
I don't think so, for two reasons.
So you could get.
Firstly, you might come up with something I don't like, and that would just screw my head up. And the second thing is, it's like the guys were saying earlier. People really can have their own impressions of what these people look like.
If you tried to force
something on them, like if you had the sort of artist did the design, you put that on the cover, and these are the people. That's not what I thought he was like. Do you know what I mean? I think so, for those two reasons, no. No, I'd rather not. I'd rather me know where I think they are, and other people know what they think they are, and I think that's the way it should be, because you know everybody sort of interprets things differently, and the way the relationships with people and the people themselves and the physical appearance is obviously the manifestation of that. Does that make sense?
Okay, I've just thought of, yeah, it does. I've just thought of one more question. Really sorry. when you're out now in town where you live, do you see them? And I don't mean like as in like the sixth sense, do you see dead people? I mean, do you happen to people to walk past and go, oh my God, that's Esteban, that's whoever, Victor, that's, has that happened to you yet?
No, not really, because I've got pictures of what I know that these guys, people look like in as you mentioned earlier, off Google. So, but what I do is, because part of the story is, there, John and Sophia will be living somewhere else. So I've lost the geography of the area now. So I've got to sort of try, if I do that, I've got to get another area. So I've got to find somewhere. So I have started thinking, oh, that person's house actually would work. But I'd have to go around and look at the parishioners and so get the joke. I mean, so it's more the area than the people, because as I said, I don't know what the people look like. And so, no, not really. I don't sort of, there's none of the characters that are sort of local. No. So probably not now.
Okay. So I suppose really the only thing you could do really is have John and Sophia come and manage Walsall or something like that, isn't it? And then you don't need to worry, do you? You don't need to worry about the areas all there in your head again.
Yeah, it's strange, you know.
You can just have them come across.
Because the local club that John goes to coach first is based on Walsall. Because I just know that club and I'll get my mind. And I never thought about them going back. Whoa, see what you've done now.
I knew if we just kept talking long enough, we would get the answers that we all wanted. Okay, Gary, I won't press you anymore, but when's it due? No, I'm kidding. We won't press you anymore. We just know the third book's coming after the Ajax book.
You might just give it to the publisher first, too. I mean,
so that's great news. He'll be fine. Either that or the spin-off. I don't mind which. I'm all right with either for now. I can do a rogue one while we wait for part three. Don't worry. All I can say, Gary, like I say, congrats. The book is brilliant. It's such a great world to visit. It definitely needed a second book, obviously, with where the first book ended. And yeah, like I say, I'm a fully paid up member of that world without a shadow of a doubt. It's a great place to be. It's a place where everybody wants to go and watch their football.
Thanks, mate. Thanks. I really appreciate all the nice things you guys have said. I mean, we've been on done so many the Centre Circle ones when we have other people on when we're talking about their books, and you always feel a bit sort of. I mean, this is probably the second or third one I've done there about my books, and you feel so self-conscious about it. And you know, it's like having a kid. You want someone to like it. Please like it. You know, slight one for this one. Introduced his girlfriend to John. And he said, "You know, please like her." You know, he's just a bit heartbroken. If nobody likes that, what you've done, but you know, he said some nice things. So thank you very much for that. Much appreciated.
Not at all, Aidan. I'm guessing you're also part of the club that is required. I want to say demanding, but I wouldn't quite say it like that. But is requiring a third. Trilogies are always better, always sound better.
Exactly. Things come in threes. So many things come in threes. It's all for a reason. It works better. It's neater. It fits. You know, it's inevitable, Gary. He's already more or less said, yes, we heard it. You know, it's just a case of exactly what. You know, it's going to happen. But overall, so much respect for Gary for having done these books, fiction, as we talked about, how hard that is to my mind anyway, and to our minds. Obviously, it's different for Gary. He can put that veil over himself and submerse himself in the world, and it's fantastic. And they're really, really good stories. It's a great pair of stories. It's really engaging. The way he tells the story, the way he tells the characters, the way the characters tell the story through Gary, it's absolutely brilliant. So heartily recommended. But I should end on the point of saying,
As it says in the book, Somos Retama. We're all Retama. We want them. We want them to do well, and we're thinking of them. So we want to know what happens next.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Stephen, for you, much inspiration for your Dinosaur Football on the Moon book that you've got.
Totally. Totally. Dinosaurs, football on the moon, on roller skates. See, I am already expanding this theme. But I'd just like to echo everything that Adrian said there. It's a fantastic book, and you know, just go out there and buy it.
Bless you, got it.
And that's exactly it. Like I say, there's two parts to this. Don't, if you've not bought the games people play, don't buy this one first. You have to buy the first one, read that one, or obviously buy them as a pair. It's close to Christmas. What better way to spend your sort of Christmas week than getting caught up with where we all are in Gary's fictional world? Because it is a great place to hang out and watch football. Congratulations. Like everyone said, nothing but absolute admiration, Gary, for what you've done, and how you do it is beyond me. It really is.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated. Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, go buy the book, guys. Go buy the book. Anybody listening, please. I'll just do said buy both. And actually, the first one is on really, really cheap option on Amazon at the moment, so it's a good time to buy it.
It would make a great, in all seriousness, two books over Christmas, just sat by the fire. If you want to get lost for a week or so in the world of Spanish football, it's a great place. It is a great place to inhabit. All that's left for me to say is thank you for listening. Gary, congratulations. Please join us again next time on the Lob podcast, where it's Dinosaurs on the Moon. but until then, thank you for listening. Please join us again next time. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.